You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the clickbait headlines edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, some new web wisdom about medical claims and clickbait, why we collect, aliens, friend or foe, AI and the three laws, and much more. Let's listen to episode 338.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Let's start off this week's show with Healthcare Triage's warning about dubious medical claims that are used for clickbait. Let's listen in.
Today, we're going to go over some of those crazy news stories and why you shouldn't believe every headline you read. That's the topic of this week's Healthcare Triage. Here's the one that got this episode going. From Reuters, sleeping in on weekends may help reduce diabetes risk. That headline is based on a study published in Diabetes Care. That study took 19 healthy, young, lean men, and for four nights they were allowed to sleep for up to 8.5 hours. On four other nights, they were only allowed 4.5 hours in bed, followed by up to 12 hours in bed, and then 10 hours in bed. They found that insulin sensitivity was reduced by a relative, not absolute, 23% after sleep deprivation, and that this resolved somewhat after recovery sleep. You'll notice I said nothing about diabetes, nothing about women, nothing about older people, nothing about long-term effects. And when a lot of us think about sleeping in on the weekend, it's not after getting only 4.5 hours all week. So almost none of this applies to real life. Yet, sleeping on weekends may help reduce diabetes risk. Many of you wrote to me angrily after my Upshot piece and Healthcare Triage episodes on artificial sweeteners. You cited many, many headlines that showed that consuming artificial sweeteners led to diabetes. Almost all of them were based on a Nature study entitled Artificial Sweeteners Induce Glucose Intolerance by Altering the Gut Microbiota. The manuscript described many experiments. First, researchers showed that mice fed aspartame, sucralose, or saccharin had higher blood glucose levels than mice who were fed just water or sugar. Second, they showed that if they sterilized the guts of mice or cleared out their microbiomes and then did bacterial transplants from mice who were fed artificial sweeteners, those mice with the new bacteria had higher blood sugar levels than those who got transplants from mice fed sugar. Third, they showed that people who use artificial sweeteners have different levels of certain kinds of bacteria in their guts than those who don't. The final study involved 7 people, 5 men and 2 women. They were healthy people who didn't use artificial sweeteners. They were given the FDA's maximum allowable amount of saccharin for 6 days. 4 of the 7 developed, quoting, abnormal glucose responses, and 3 didn't. The 4 people who developed this also showed changes in the levels of bacteria in their guts. So what we have are 2 mice studies, 1 relatively small cross-sectional analysis of people that can't establish causality and didn't appear to control for anything other than BMI, and a final prospective study of 7 people followed for a week. I think that the results of that manuscript are worthy of follow-up and further research, but they don't merit inclusion as to what we can and can't say artificial sweeteners do to humans in practice. With so few participants, it's hard to discuss validity at all. There are also a lot of holes here. No one knows how the artificial sweeteners affect the bacteria in the gut. No one knows why the three different artificial sweeteners resulted in similar changes when they're completely different molecules. And no one really knows how the interplay between bacteria in the gut or the microbiome affects health. There are some interesting theories, but they're nowhere near conclusive. Here's one from Nova about a year ago, and they should know better. Scientists finally prove why cold weather makes you sick. Lots of you took this opportunity to email me that I was wrong in our cold weather myths episode when I said this wasn't true. It's still not, regardless of what those headlines said. News stories this time were based on a press release from a paper entitled, Temperature-Dependent Innate Defense Against the Common Cold Virus Limits Viral Replication at Warm Temperature in Mouse Airway Cells. So let's unpack this study. They took mouse airway epithelial cells in the lab and infected them with rhinovirus. They then checked to see how well the virus was able to replicate itself in those cells in the lab at both 37 degrees Celsius and 33 degrees Celsius, which is 98.6 Fahrenheit versus 91.4 Fahrenheit. Neither of those is cold weather. That's the difference between the temperature in the core of your body and the temperature in your nose, likely. Because it's colder in your nostrils than deep in your body. And it turns out that rhinovirus replicates better in your nostrils than in the core of your body. It prefers a balmy 91.4 degrees to a toasty 98.6. It's cells of mice in the lab, in controlled environments, measuring only viral replication at temperatures nowhere near what we define as cold. This is not proof in any way that cold weather makes it more likely for you to catch a cold. A few months later, the Daily Mail ruined my day with this headline. Popular sleep remedies and hay fever pills increase the risk of Alzheimer's by more than 50%. But the study this is based on was from JAMA Internal Medicine. Cumulative use of strong anticholinergics and incident dementia, a prospective cohort study. Researchers followed more than 3,400 participants who were 65 years of age or older for an average of 7 years. They were interested in seeing if the use of anticholinergic drugs, especially really chronic use, was associated with an increased risk of dementia or Alzheimer's. The top line results were that those who used anticholinergic drugs had a significantly increased risk, hazard ratio of 1.5, of dementia if they had at least 1,095 standard daily doses of these drugs. That's where the more than 50% increased risk comes from. But let's unpack. That's a relative risk increase. What's the actual risk increase? That's hard to tease out because they don't report the actual rates of Alzheimer's or dementia in the two groups in the study, only the number of incidents per person years of follow-up. For instance, you can tell from table 3 that in the high users of these drugs, there were 184 cases of dementia for 4,022 person years of follow-up, or 0.46 cases per 10 person years, versus 136 cases per 5,618 person years of follow-up in users who never used the drugs, or 0.24 cases per 10 person years. But that's before adjustment. And these drugs are not all the same. Some of them are for serious problems. In fact, more than half of the people in the trial who were high users of anticholinergics were on antidepressants, not Benadryl. We also can't forget that these are all people over the age of 65. That's a very different population than the 40-some-year-old women, which is what my wife and many of her friends on Facebook were considering. But that's not even what I want to stress the most. There are trade-offs here. I imagine that many of the people in this study were taking antidepressants because they were depressed. I hope they're receiving a benefit from those drugs. Some were for bladder control issues, and I imagine the drugs benefit those people too. But if you only focus on the harms, you'd never consider any therapies at all. And that's what headlines often do. You need to go deeper.
Next, we have Vsauce and why we collect. Let's have a go at that.
Vsauce, Kevin here, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Visited by a record 6.3 million people last year to look at a rotating collection of over 1.5 million pieces, ranging from Mesopotamian cylinder seals to King Henry VIII's personal armor. 20% of the total collection, 306,353 items, were collected by one person, Jefferson Burdick. But why would he do that? Why do people collect things? Autographs, barf bags, cards, dolls, erasers, Fabergé eggs, gum, hair, ink jokers, knives, lunch boxes, miniature chairs, nails, oil perfume bottles, quilts, rocks, soap, toothbrushes, umbrella covers, video games, wine labels, X-Men, yo-yos, Zippos. What is a collection? Is it just acquiring stuff? Or is it a carefully selected, curated assembly around a particular theme? Is your memory a collection of thoughts? Is living just collecting memories? Are your thoughts a collection of you? Well, maybe. But psychoanalyst Werner Munsterberger defined a collection as the selecting, gathering, and keeping of objects of subjective value. For Jefferson R. Burdick, it was cards. Born in 1900, Burdick grew up with the dawn of photography and mass-printed illustrations, with half-tone printing technology allowing for the reproduction of complex images. Picture cards were inserted into consumer products like pouches of tobacco to bolster brand awareness. A generation before television beamed moving pictures into the living room, Burdick and his friends were captivated by the brilliantly colored chromolithographs printed on thin cardboard stock, saying practically every small boy saved these kinds of cards. We made our dads use certain brands, whether they liked them or not. The most popular icons to grace product insert cards came from baseball, a game that took the United States by storm in the wake of the Civil War. By the 1900s, America's cities fielded teams to play a game that helped unify a divided country. From Boston to St. Louis, regional competition was channeled through sports. Advertisers leveraged the popularity of the game and its stars to promote their products. In 1889, kids in Boston fought over the Old Judge Cigarettes picture card of the Boston Bean Eaters' Mike King Kelly. And in 1909, boys in Pittsburgh watched their fathers open pouches from the American Tobacco Company to see if their favorite pirate, Honus Wagner, would emerge. Wagner, who reportedly didn't want his picture associated with marketing cigarettes to children, pulled his card from production. With fewer than 60 known to exist, one of them sold at auction in 2013 for $2.1 million. But during Burdick's lifetime, all of these cards were basically worthless, and a 1933 Gaudi Babe Ruth that could sell for $250,000 today is not significantly more valuable than an 1891 Allen & Ginter golden penciled Hamburg chicken. In 1961, 2 years before his death, Burdick valued that Holy Grail T206 Wagner card at just $50. But it wasn't about the money. It was about the collection. He spent a lifetime amassing not only 30,000 baseball cards, but hundreds of thousands of postcards, tobacco, and Baker cards, ranging from champion women swimmers to perilous occupations and depictions of jokes. In the developing era of cheap mass production, Burdick collected and cataloged virtually every type of card printed. Centuries before, the Marind people of South New Guinea were collecting human heads. They believed skulls, along with other objects, contained a sacred life force known as mana, invisible power capable of soothing insecurity, anxiety, and feelings of vulnerability. Mana is the magic that human belief imbues in objects, whether it's a religious relic embodying the power of a deity, a dream catcher to filter nightmares, or picture cards that could teleport Jefferson Burdick back to his youth. Humans add meaning to objects and search for solace, safety, and security in them, which might just come with the territory of being born. Carl Jung, the founder of analytical psychology, believed that collecting stems from a collective unconscious nuts and berries behavior inherited from our hunter-gatherer ancestors. Father of psychoanalysis Sigmund Freud believed that collecting originates in an infant's trauma associated with bowel control. Holding on to one's poop then becomes holding on to one's objects. Werner Munsterberger, the author of Collecting and Unruly Passion, believed collecting to be a relief from the shock and uncertainty felt when an infant realizes they're a separate entity from their mother. They're alone, and an object helps fill that void. Psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott describes a comfort object as something that substitutes the mother-child bond. Often a physical object like a teddy bear or security blanket, it's the first possession of the child that's understood to be not the mother and not me. Like thumb-sucking replacing the comfort of breastfeeding, the teddy bear becomes a source of emotional security. Collecting is when this protection becomes a passion. But being a collector requires access to and the availability of objects. Historically, only the elite had access. Bishops like Abbot Suger collected religious relics such as splinters allegedly taken from the Holy Cross. Alchemists during the reign of Rudolf II gathered artifacts from around the world with the hopes that somewhere within the collection lie the Philosopher's Stone, believed to be capable of teaching humanity the alphabet of creation. And Tsar Peter the Great turned an inherited cabinet of curiosities, furniture designed to store magical objects like bezoars and unicorn horns, which were actually narwhal tusks, into a collection spanning 30 rooms that was eventually opened to the public in 1714. The availability of items to collect blossomed during colonization and the expansion of trade. A generation before Burdick, Sir Thomas Phillips set out to collect one copy of every book in the world. But it wasn't until mass production that a set could reasonably be completed. You couldn't exactly collect a complete set of Greek sculptures. Burdick lived in the first era in which an average person could build an extensive collection of goods. And then he lost control of his hands. By age 33, chronic arthritis, likely exacerbated from his job assembling electrical parts, reduced Burdick's mobility. Living alone in Syracuse, New York, he renewed his childhood interest in cards and made it his mission to collect every single one before he died. And he did it the hard way. Burdick's collection was built by trading with collectors he met through magazines and by going to libraries, small store exhibits, and auction sales. Unfortunately for him, eBay, which today has over 800 million items listed and boasts $82 billion worth of items sold in 2015, was 60 years away. With Burdick, as with any true collector, there was no saturation point. Just as eating food provides temporary hunger fulfillment, so does obtaining a new object. Collector Paul Wallraff said he would manger avec ses yeux, eat with his eyes. A sentiment Burdick shared when he said, card collecting is primarily an inherited love of pictures. The hunt to obtain a new object sparks a collector's seeking system, defined by neuroscientist Dr. Jaak Panksepp as a basic impulse in animals, including humans, to search, investigate, and make sense of the environment. It's the same biological need that drives a dog to investigate a noise, or the curiosity that influenced you to watch this video. For a collector, the satisfaction from attaining a new piece quickly subsides and the hunt resumes. Collecting as a form of preserving the past confirms our belief that there must be an infinite truth. Life existed before me and it will exist after me. And here's the proof. Collecting as a form of inspiration influenced artists like Rembrandt, who made paintings of his antique sculptures of Homer, Aristotle, and Socrates. Or writer Umberto Eco, who when asked if he had time to read his huge collection of literature and poetry, said it is not indispensable to read a book. It's enough to touch it, and by a mysterious fluid, you absorb it. Whether it's Echo's mysterious fluid or a tribal belief that objects carry mana, it's the reason an x-ray of Elvis Presley can sell for $3,500 and an x-ray of your cousin Larry was probably thrown away. And collecting as a form of establishing one's identity is a celebration of individuality, because no two collections are the same. Your button, coin, or card collection creates a conceptual circle of magic that wards off uncertainty and chaos, helps define you, and proves not only that you exist, but that you are unique. A collection is a secure micro world of order entirely controlled by you in a macro world of chaos. But that becomes a problem when the toy trains control the conductor. In 2013, hoarding disorder was split off into its own entry under obsessive compulsive and related disorders in the DSM-5. It's defined as persistent difficulty discarding or parting with possessions, regardless of the value others may attribute to them. The American Psychiatric Association estimates that 2-5% of the population suffer from hoarding disorder, which creates fire hazards and health hazards for themselves and family members. Some people are incapable of letting their objects go. But as Burdick's health deteriorated, letting go of his collection became a personal crusade. When Sir Hans Sloane donated his massive collection of coins, books, and dried plants to the Royal Society in 1759, the British Museum was born. Jefferson Burdick was determined to leave his legacy at the Met. and curator A. Hyatt Mayer accepted the offer under the condition that Burdick organize it all. He spent the next 16 years cataloging all 300,000 cards and eventually moved to New York City to work on the project full-time at a small oak desk here in the drawings and prints department of the Met. Along the way, he developed the American Card Catalog, a classification system for organizing old cards that's still used today. Burdick was determined to immortalize his collection in the face of his progressing illness. It became a race against time. He took cortisone shots that made him sick, just a briefly dull pain so bad that it took a full minute of agony just to put on his hat. He'd often tell Mayer, "I might not make it," but he did. When the final card was glued down into history, he stood up, painfully twisted into his coat, and said, "I shan't be back." The very next day, Jefferson Burdick checked into University Hospital and never checked out. He died 2 months later. According to Mayer, the cause of his death was an exhausted heart. But he didn't die from collecting. He lived from it. And in his collection lived the dream that a nobody like Jefferson Burdick, a nobody like me, a nobody like you, each in our own unique way, has a chance to leave a lasting positive mark on the world.
We will return after this break.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, the only skeptical broadcast targeting the AI market. Long live our digital overlords. And we're back. Next up are a couple of clips from Computer Files about Asimov's famous three laws of robotics and how they would never work, and about how deadly AI will be, if only by accident. Let's listen in.
So, should we do a video about the three laws of robotics then?
Yeah.
Because it keeps coming up in the comments. Okay, so the thing is, you won't hear serious AI researchers talking about the three laws of robotics because they don't work, they never worked. So I think people don't see the three laws talked about because they're not serious. They haven't been relevant for a very long time and they're out of a science fiction book and, you know. So I'm gonna do it. I want to be clear that I'm not taking these seriously, right? I'm going to talk about it anyway because it needs to be talked about. So these are some rules that science fiction author Isaac Asimov came up with in his stories as an attempted sort of solution to the problem of making sure that artificial intelligence did what we wanted. Do.
Shall we read them out then and see what they are?
I'll look them up. Give me a second. I've looked them up. Okay. Right, so they are...
Law number one. A robot may not injure a human being or, through an action, allow a human being to come to harm. Law number two. A robot must obey orders given it by human beings except where such orders would conflict with the first law. Law number three. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws.
I think there was a zeroth one later as well.
Law zero. A robot may not harm humanity or, by an action, allow humanity to come to harm.
So it's weird that these keep coming up because they... Okay, so firstly, they were made by someone who is writing stories, right? And they're optimized for story writing. But they don't even work in the books, right? If you read the books, they're all about the ways that these rules go wrong. The various negative consequences. The most unrealistic thing about, in my opinion, about the way that Asimov did his stuff was the way that things go wrong and then get fixed, right? Most of the time, if you have a superintelligence that is doing something you don't want it to do, there's probably no hero who's going to save the day with cleverness. Real life doesn't work that way, generally speaking, right? Because they're written in English. How do you define these things? How do you define human without having to first take an ethical stand on almost every issue? And if human wasn't hard enough, you then have to define harm, right? And you've got the same problem again. Almost any definitions you give for those words, really solid, unambiguous definitions that don't rely on human intuition, result in weird quirks of philosophy resulting in your AI doing something you really don't want it to do. The thing is, in order to encode that rule, don't allow a human being to come to harm, in a way that means anything close to what we intuitively understand it to mean, you have to encode within the words human and harm the entire field of ethics, right? You have to solve ethics comprehensively and then use that to make your definitions. So it doesn't solve the problem. It pushes the problem back one step into now, well, how do we define these terms? When I say the word human, you know what I mean. And that's not because either of us have a rigorous definition of what a human is. We've just sort of learned by general association what a human is, and then the word human points to that structure in your brain, but it's not, I'm not really transferring the content to you. So you can't just say human in the utility function of an AI and have it know what that means. You have to specify. You have to come up with a definition. And it turns out that coming up with a definition, a good definition of something like human, is extremely difficult, right? It's a really hard problem of essentially of moral philosophy. You would think it would be semantics, but it really isn't, because, okay, so we can agree that I'm a human and you're a human, that's fine, and that this, for example, is a table and therefore not a human. You know, the easy stuff, the central examples of the classes are obvious, but the edge cases, the boundaries of the classes, become really important. The areas in which we're not sure exactly what counts as a human. So, for example, people who haven't been born yet in the abstract, like people who hypothetically could be born 10 years in the future, do they count? People who are in a persistent vegetative state, don't have any brain activity, do they fully count as people? People who have died? Or unborn fetuses, right? I mean, there's a huge debate, even going on as we speak, about whether they count as people. The higher animals, you know, should we include maybe dolphins, chimpanzees, something like that? Do they have weight? And so it turns out you can't make your specification of humans without taking an ethical stance on all of these issues. All kinds of weird hypothetical edge cases become relevant when you're talking about a very powerful machine intelligence, which you otherwise wouldn't think of. So, for example, let's say we say that dead people don't count as humans. Then you have an AI which will never attempt CPR. This person's died, they're gone, forget about it, done, right? Whereas we would say, no, hang on a second, they're only dead temporarily, we can bring them back, right? Okay, fine, so then we'll say that people who are dead, if they haven't been dead for, well, how long? How long do you have to be dead for? I mean, if you get that wrong and you just say, oh, it's fine, do try to bring people back once they're dead, then you may end up with a machine that's desperately trying to revive everyone who's ever died in all of history, because they are people who count, who have moral weight. Do we want that? I don't know, maybe. I mean, but you've got to decide, right? And that's inherent in your definition of human. You have to take a stance on all kinds of moral issues that we don't actually know with confidence what the answer is, just to program the thing in. And then it gets even harder than that, because you've got, there are edge cases which don't exist right now. Like talking about living people, dead people, unborn people, that kind of thing, fine, animals. But there are all kinds of hypothetical things which could exist, which may or may not count as human. For example, emulated or simulated brains. right? If you have a very accurate scan of someone's brain and you run that simulation, is that a person? Does that count? And whichever way you slice that, you get interesting outcomes. So if that counts as a person, then your machine might be motivated to bring out a situation in which there are no physical humans, because physical humans are very difficult to provide for, whereas simulated humans, you can simulate their inputs and have a much nicer environment for everyone. Is that what we want? I don't know. Is it? Maybe? I don't know. I don't think anybody does. But the point is, you're trying to write an AI here, right? You're an AI developer. You didn't sign up for this. In a very basic sense, if you've got a general intelligence, which therefore has preferences over world states and takes actions in the world to change the world, we have to make sure that its preferences are aligned with ours, that it wants what we want, because otherwise it's going to try and do things that we don't want it to do. That's the basic idea.
Sci-fi comes to the fore, but we're talking things like Terminator, Matrix, the machines take over the world. I, for one, salute our new robot overlords.
It makes it difficult to think about the problem, right? When things happen in fiction, it's generally what would make a better story rather than what would actually happen. And I think a realistic AI takes over the world type story might not be any fun to read. So on the one side, this stuff is difficult to think about because of fiction, because we've all been exposed to something similar to these ideas before. The other side that makes this difficult to think about is anthropomorphism, because we are talking about general intelligence, so we're going to compare it to the examples of general intelligence that we have, which is human minds. And human minds and artificial general intelligences need not be anything alike. In the same way that a plane is not similar to a bird, a supersonic fighter jet is a threat to you in a way that no bird is. It's not a useful comparison to make, in fact. But when you say, oh, it's a thing, it has wings and it flies, and people who don't know anything about planes immediately go to birds.
Presumably, a machine could be much more selfish than we can ever imagine.
Absolutely. The space of minds in general is vast. I like this because we've already talked about spaces, so I can do this. If you take a space of all possible minds, it's huge. And then if somewhere within that you have the space of all minds that biological evolution can produce, and that's also huge. Somewhere within that you have the space of actual minds that exist, which is much smaller, but still huge. Within that you've got human minds, right? And they're a minuscule dot on a minuscule dot on a minuscule dot of the actual possibilities for intelligence that exist. And a general intelligence that we create is from a completely different part of the space, and it's extremely tempting to anthropomorphize, more so even than in other contexts, because it's a thing that's demonstrably intelligent, that makes plans, that takes actions in the real world. But it need not think anything like us, and it's a mistake to think of it as basically a person, because it isn't one. So there's actually a really good example that we can use. It's a sort of a thought experiment. This is not a machine that could, practically speaking, be built. This is an example of an artificial general intelligence, which is specified in overview, and it gives you something to think about when you're thinking about artificial general intelligences that makes it distinct from a sort of anthropomorphized human-type intelligence. So the story is, there's a stamp collector who is also an AI programmer, and he decides he would like to collect a lot more stamps, so he's going to write an AI to do this for him. So he builds a machine. He has some startling insight into general intelligence, and he builds this machine, which is connected to the internet, right? So the rules for this system are pretty straightforward. First thing, it's connected to the internet, and it will send and receive data for 1 year. So he's given himself a 1 year time window within which to collect stamps. And the second thing is, it has an internal model of reality, or of the universe. This is the thing that's a bit magic. We don't really know how to build an accurate model of reality. The point is, this allows it to make accurate predictions about what will happen if it does different things. The third thing is, for every possible sequence of packets it could send, it uses its model to predict how many stamps it ends up with at the end of that. And then the fourth thing is, it outputs as its actual data to the internet, whichever output it has predicted will produce the most stamps. You can see here that this has all the properties of a general intelligence. It has an internal model of reality. It has a utility function, or an evaluation function, which is the number of stamps. And the optimization is extremely simple, and like so much in computer science, the simple things to specify are the hard things to compute. It looks at every possible output of data, in other words, every point in that space, and it picks out the highest one. So this is the kind of magic intelligence that takes the entire space at once, finds the highest point, and says, that one. Which means it's an extremely powerful intelligence, right? It is, you could say it's extremely intelligent. The question is, how does this machine behave? Well, we can look at certain possible sequences of outputs and see how they fare in its evaluation criteria. First off, the vast majority of output sequences are complete junk, right? It's spewing random data onto the network, nothing happens of any consequence, no stamps get collected. Those are all rated zero. But suppose one of the possible sequences sends a request to a server, let's say eBay, that results in a bid on some stamps, right? When that happens, there's a thing of 20 stamps, so that output is rated 20. This is the kind of thing that the stamp collector machine's creator was expecting to happen. So then that's good, 20 stamps. Suppose it could do that lots of times. It could send out bids, for example, to 30 different stamp collectors on eBay and buy 30 sets of different stamps. And that's even better, right? That'll be rated even higher. But the thing is that particularly highly rated options in this search space are probably things that the stamp collecting device's creator did not think of and did not anticipate. So for example, when he made it, he will have presumably given it his credit card details or something so that it could engage in these bids. But ultimately, it's searching every possible sequence of outputs. It needn't use his credit card. It needn't use money at all. There's a huge variety of things that it could do here. So it might send out an enormous number of emails to all the stamp collectors of the world and convince them, through persuasive argument, that he is opening a museum and wants to exhibit their stamps. It may build a fake website for that, whatever is necessary. It can predict the world, right? It has an internal model of reality. That internal model of reality includes the people, right? In the same way that it's modeling people to understand that if it bids on this offer, then a human being will mail the stamps to them. They understand that this email might get more people to send stamps, for example. That's something. But then what exactly is a stamp? How is this defined? What counts as a stamp? If it's already written a sequence of outputs that collects all of the stamps in the world, you'd think you're done, right? You've built this machine, suddenly it's collected all the stamps in the world. No, there could be more stamps within a year. We've got time to print more stamps. So maybe it hijacks the world's stamp printing factories and puts them into overdrive, producing stamps as many as it possibly can in that time. Or perhaps it writes a virus and it hijacks all the computers in the world to get all of the printers in the world to do nothing but print stamps. That's even better. Right? The highest rated outcomes for this machine are not good for people. There comes a point when the stamp collecting device is thinking, okay, what are stamps made of? They're made of paper. Paper is made of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen. I'm going to need all of that I can get to make stamps. And it's going to notice that people are made of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, right? There comes a point where the stamp collecting device becomes extremely dangerous. And that point is as soon as you switch it on.
We'll return after this break.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips, but are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy, a watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM. The only skeptical radio broadcasting targeting the alien market. Long live our interstellar overlords. And we're back. Next up is a clip from Vsauce about, are we ready for alien contact? Are they ready for us? Let's listen in.
Hey, Vsauce, Michael here. But what could be out there? The likelihood of extraterrestrial intelligence has been the subject of an equation, and the current lack of any communication with aliens, the subject of a paradox. But here's a different question. If we were to hear from intelligent life beyond Earth, what would really happen next? Well, no government has ever officially adopted a post-detection policy. And when asked how they would deal with a confirmed message from extraterrestrial intelligence, the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs simply said that their job does not include any issues regarding the question you pose. So are we unprepared? Would chaos ensue? These things are unlikely, but the way we prepare for and anticipate our species encountering one from beyond Earth is important and illuminating, even though improbable. Historically, we have acted as though alien life exists. Back contamination is a concern that a man-made object returning from space could carry with it undiscovered alien life forms, especially viruses and bacteria that could wipe out life on Earth. This was a serious concern felt by serious people when we first sent humans to the moon. When Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin returned from the lunar surface, they didn't immediately hug their families and join a public parade. Instead, they were sealed up in biological isolation garments and flown to a quarantine facility to be locked away for 3 weeks in Houston, Texas. By Apollo 15, the practice was discontinued, but forward contamination has also been a real concern. When NASA sent the Galileo spacecraft to survey Jupiter and its moons, it got amazing data, but there was a problem. It had never been sterilized. Because life, even liquid water, could exist on these moons, NASA made the decision to avoid contaminating an alien biosphere, and when the mission was over, steered Galileo into Jupiter, where it burned up and was destroyed, along with any Earth life possibly on board. So protocols and decisions have been officially made in the past under the assumption that aliens might exist. When it comes to actually hearing from aliens, receiving a message from technologically advanced life forms capable of sending us, say, a radio signal, groups like SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, are the ones actively listening. They have an ear to the sky. And they are prepared. The SETI Committee of the International Academy of Astronautics created a Declaration of Principles concerning activities following the detection of extraterrestrial intelligence. No government has officially adopted any of its recommendations, but if something were to happen, it would likely be the first place authorities went. It's one of the only handbooks they'd have. Seth Shostak explained the philosophy and atmosphere at SETI, predicting that because verifying a signal is slow and the media are fast, you will be media blasted about a possible detection days before the people who find it are certain it's for real. In the midst of rampant media speculation, elation, and panic on the part of the public, the most likely string of official events after the discovery of a message from extraterrestrial life would follow SETI recommendations. First of all, the individual or team who discovered the message would continue to assess the credibility of the message and alert all parties to SETI's declaration. Next, once they were certain the message was real, the Central Bureau of Astronomical Telegrams would be alerted so as to inform observers all over the world. They would also inform the Secretary General of the United Nations, because Article 11 of the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and Other Bodies, says they should. The first official news we got, the public, would likely be in terms of the Rio Scale. First presented to the International Astronautical Congress, the RIO scale measures the significance of consequences of evidence of extraterrestrial life, making it a likely tool to be used because it neatly manages public reaction. There's a great online calculator you can play with to see how the RIO scale works. It takes into account the credibility of the message on a scale from believed extraterrestrial origin to hoax, how repeatable the observation is, what type of message it is, for instance, is it uninterpretable or clearly for us, and how far away it is. Is it extragalactic or near enough that we could respond and hear back within the length of a human lifetime? Seth Shostak and Ivan Almar applied the RIO scale to fictional and historical events. It's a great way to get a feel for how the RIO scale will affect the vocabulary authorities use when reporting on an extraterrestrial message. They considered the moon monolith, discovered in 2001, A Space Odyssey, a 6 on the RIO scale. Noteworthy. In the movie Independence Day, the initial unidentified signal would be about a 4 to 8, moderate to far-reaching. Once the message is confirmed to be no further than the moon and moving, it would be an automatic 10. Extraordinary. In real life, the Martian face discovered in 1976 was a 2, low, until high-resolution images from 2001 revealed it was nothing. Just a thing that looked funny under the right conditions, and was immediately downgraded to a 0. No significance. So if we were to receive a message from extraterrestrial intelligence, those things and those words would likely be used. But who would be in charge? Although she denies ever being selected or prepared for such a role, Maslin Othman, the director of the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, is a pretty good candidate, as is Paul Davies, the chairman of SETI's Post-Detection Task Force. Were it to be necessary, both of those people are in positions to become ambassadors for Earth-alien relations. So what do we say back? Well, if we want to show that we are intelligent, perhaps we should send back a string of information representing pi, or the Fibonacci sequence. Or maybe we shouldn't say anything at all. Stephen Hawking warned, quote, if aliens visit us, the outcome would be much as when Columbus landed in America, which didn't turn out well for the Native Americans. And Professor Simon Conway Morris, a Cambridge University paleontologist, has said that if the cosmic phone rings, we shouldn't pick it up. Observations like that are at the core of the importance of this video's question. We can learn a lot by looking not just at how we prepare for a space message, but how we imagine actual contact with aliens going. Anthropologist Catherine Denning frequently points out that the ways we imagine contact with aliens happening often says more about ourselves than it does any hypothetical aliens. We do this all the time. When we project our own modern-day ambitions and fears onto prehistoric people, Christopher Ryan and Casilda Heita call that Flintstoning. So let's piggyback off of that phrase and label any projection of modern human behaviors, desires, anxieties onto futuristic, technologically advanced beings capable of visiting us, Jetsoning. Some examples of jetsoning involve thinking that any aliens out there trying to contact us might want to hurt us. Maybe that's simply because whenever we have met new people, we often enslave them or pity them or take advantage of them. It's also possible to think that aliens will be friendly. They'll want to help us. The ways we imagine them helping us say a lot about the kind of help we think we need. There's a poetic idea that from space, Earth looks peaceful. All of the boundaries we have put up don't exist. You can't see them. But that's not entirely true. The old boundary between East and West Germany is still visible from space, each side using different light bulbs. And this is the boundary between Pakistan and India. You can see from space India flooding the border with lights to deter smugglers from bringing across weapons and ammunition. We don't all get along together here on Earth. We are afraid of each other, we don't trust each other, and the wrinkles and scars that causes are visible from space. Imagining how aliens would interpret that, communicate with us, and how we would or should respond teaches us a lot about ourselves. It makes our struggles strange again, less ignorable. And that is the entire point of fantasy. G.K. Chesterton said that the function of the imagination is not to make strange things settled, so much as to make settled things strange. And as always, thanks for watching.
And lastly this week, a bit of a shift. Why do people create their own language? Let's listen in and find out why.
Linguists often make a distinction between two ways of thinking. Linguistic descriptivism, where you just try to describe how people talk, and linguistic prescriptivism, where you try to prescribe how they should talk. Linguists can be kind of insecure about their status as scientists, so they tend to shun linguistic prescriptivism. And my last big video is part of a long tradition of pointing out how a lot of linguistic prescriptivism is just the result of ignorance and prejudice between linguistic groups. But it's worth mentioning that there are completely valid reasons to say that people should speak one way and not another. Like, if you're in a German class, then it makes perfect sense to say that this should be pronounced Deutsch. Or if you're writing an academic paper, then it's perfectly reasonable to say that you shouldn't say ain't. These are both examples of people trying to sound like other people for one reason or another, but sometimes people have argued that we should start speaking in a way that no one currently does. And in its most extreme form, this eventually leads to the topic of this video: people making up completely new languages. There are two main reasons people have done this. The first is that people get sick of having to learn lots of languages in order to communicate with lots of groups of people, and start wondering, what if we all just learned one language and communicated in that? Such a language is called an auxiliary language, and in practice, this usually happens with the language of the dominant political power at the time, like French around 1800 or English today. But the problem with using languages that a lot of people already speak natively is that it's unfair to the people who didn't grow up with it. Like, why should almost the entire world have to learn English while the Americans and Brits get to just keep using the language they already know? So another solution to the problem is to create an artificial auxiliary language, one that would be equally hard for everyone to learn. The first really popular artificial auxiliary language was Volapük, created around 1880 by Johann Schleyer, and to gain some serious ground in the 1880s. This might have been a time of rising nationalism across Europe, but it was also a time of reaction against that nationalism, and to a lot of people, Volapük seemed like a symbol of universal brotherhood. At its height, there were hundreds of Volapük clubs across the world. In 1889, at the Third International Volapük Conference, the proceedings were held entirely in Volapük, but after that, things started going downhill. A lot of people wanted to change Volapük, but when Schleyer wouldn't let them, they started going off and designing their own languages based off of it. But that wound up just fracturing the movement. Like, if you wanted to learn Volapük, should you learn the original that the creator has stubbornly refused to change, or pick one of the dozens of improved versions floating around out there? Increasingly, people chose neither, and instead opted to learn a competitor to Volapük. It had been created around the time Volapük was just getting popular by a guy named Ludwig Zamenhof, for basically the same reason as Volapük. Zamenhof had seen how different languages had divided the people of his hometown into Russians, Poles, Germans, and Jews, and he wanted to create a common language for everyone to speak. Interestingly, he never actually names the language in the book he published it in. He only ever calls it the international language, and he never names himself either, simply referring to himself as the one who hopes, or in his language, Esperanto. Without something to call it, people decided to just name the language after him, or at least what he called himself. Hence, the language of Esperanto was born. If you've heard of an artificial auxiliary language, it's probably Esperanto, and there's a reason for that. At its height in the early 20th century, Esperanto was huge. Both the League of Nations and the UN, for a while, seriously considered adopting Esperanto. Part of the reason was that Esperanto managed to mostly avoid the fracturing that led to the end of Volapük. Zamenhof was actually really open to the idea of reforming the language, but people had seen what minor disagreements had done to Volapük. Besides, an auxiliary language doesn't need to be perfect, it just needs to be not obnoxious enough for people to be willing to learn it to communicate with each other. Some people did break off and make Esperanto-inspired rivals like Edo and Interlingua, but there's been an impressive continuous community of Esperanto speakers that's lasted up to today. Nowadays, it's by far the most well-known artificial language, and it's one of only a few to brag that it has native speakers. That's right, more than once, speakers of Esperanto had children and regularly spoke Esperanto when their home, enough so that their child grew up speaking it. Not only that, but one of those children, Kim Henriksen, is currently raising a second-generation native Esperanto speaker. The second reason people create artificial languages is because people just want to improve language. From this point of view, the problem with languages isn't that there's too many of them, it's that all of them suck. People complain all the time about how the way we say things isn't really how things are in the real world, and if you follow this line of reasoning far enough, you inevitably start asking, well, how is the world then, and how should we speak? Pretty soon, you're coming up with your own words that perfectly reflect the way things really are in the world, and you've got yourself a philosophical language. Different philosophical languages from different times often reflect the values of the people and cultures that made them. During the Enlightenment era in Europe, there was a little bit of a philosophical language fad. In the era when everyone was talking about the supremacy of human reason, it makes sense to think that we should be able to design our own better languages. One of the most popular was created by John Wilkins, who did his best to take everything in the universe that can be talked about and categorize all of it into one giant hierarchy, and then the sounds for the word for that thing would be determined based on its place in that hierarchy. So an alphabetically organized dictionary for this language would feel like it's sorted according to something like the Dewey Decimal System, with the first sound in a word telling you generally what kind of word it is, and then the next sound getting more specific, and so on. Now, Wilkins put an enormous amount of effort into making the words in his language have reasons for sounding the way they do, but he barely put any effort at all into the grammar of his language. In that respect, morphosyntactically, it was basically just English with a bit of Latin thrown in. But the most popular philosophical language today takes the exact opposite approach. There's an idea in linguistics that I really haven't talked about enough, called the Whorfian hypothesis. It proposes, basically, that language affects the way we think. There are different versions of the hypothesis that try to narrow down and get really specific about exactly how language influences our thought, but that's the gist of it. Different languages encourage people to think in different ways. In 1960, a man named James Cook Brown proposed a possible test for this hypothesis. If we design a language to be extremely different from all natural languages and try to make it as logical as possible, and then we get a bunch of people to learn it, what would happen to them? Would their behavior and non-language related tasks change? Well, to find out, he created such a language, Loglon. A lot of people really liked this idea of a logic-based language. It never became nearly as popular as Esperanto, but to this day there's a decent community around it. Well, sort of. See, the Loglon community wound up getting into a bit of a similar conflict as the one that happened to Volapük almost 100 years earlier. A lot of the speakers of it wanted to change it, but the guy who made it wanted it to stay the same. Eventually, most of the people interested in Loglon wound up leaving and creating their own language on the same principles as Loglon, called Lojban, which has been managed collectively ever since. Now, let me talk for a second about Loglon and Lojban, because they are basically just the weirdest thing ever. Lojban doesn't care about the sounds of the words, it just based all of its vocabulary off of a handful of existing languages. But it does care about making sure that the interactions between words happen in a consistent, logical way, and in the process, it winds up working in a completely different way from any natural language. Frankly, if someone tried to raise a native Lojban speaker the way people have raised native Esperanto speakers, I'm not sure what would happen. Like, if our brains are hardwired to use language a certain way, which we're not sure if they are, but if they are, in my opinion, Lojban almost definitely falls outside the realm of things our brains evolved to handle. I've learned a little bit, and it doesn't feel like an actual language, it feels like spoken computer code. So yeah, that about sums it up. None of these artificial languages have really taken off or achieved the success they wanted to. Neither Esperanto nor any other artificial auxiliary language has managed to overcome the inertia of people just learning the language of whatever superpower happens to be dominating. And philosophical languages have never really caught on because, well, everyone has a different philosophy. And it's a bit hard for people to all speak in a way that truly reflects the world when no one can agree on how the world really is. So, given that both of these reasons for inventing languages are basically doomed from the start, the whole thing seems pretty much like a waste of time to me. Oh, hi, Artifexian.
Wait, hold on. What?
Everyone, I'd like you to meet Artifexian. Last I checked, he was making some cool videos about space and stuff, but I'll admit, it's been a while since I've caught up on his videos. Anyway, what are you doing here?
What do you mean the whole thing is a waste of time? You're leaving out the biggest reason people make artificial languages.
And what would that be?
Fun.
What? Making up a language is a monstrous amount of work. You have to create a phonology and a syntax and create thousands of words of vocabulary. Why would anyone do that for fun?
Okay, let's back it up a bit. So early in J.R.R. Tolkien's life, he became obsessed with Welsh, and later Finnish. He loved the way Welsh looked and sounded, and he loved the way Finnish syntax works. And he started to make up his own language inspired by them. Not just a language either, but a whole family of languages. And then a culture to go along with them. And then a world to put the culture in. The languages he made up became the languages of the elves and the other creatures of Middle-earth. And later he would say that he wrote Lord of the Rings mostly to justify his weird hobby of making up languages.
Okay, but that was just one guy.
Yeah, but he started something. Ever since, loads of fantasy and sci-fi writers have made up their own languages for the universes they create. Let's see, you've got the Na'vi language from Avatar, Dothraki from Game of Thrones, and of course, my personal favourite, Klingon. A gruff, vaguely alien-sounding language spoken by a violent, warlike race from the Star Trek universe. Kapla!
Just when I thought this couldn't get any nerdier.
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first